Welcome back to the Religions of the Ancient Mediterranean podcast. My name is Phil Harland. I'm a prof at York University. This is the series, The Historical Jesus in Context. We're finally beginning to explore more fully some of the detailed questions regarding who was Jesus, the historical Jesus, that is, that person who came from Nazareth in Galilee. We're beginning to look at some of the roles Jesus took on, roles that existed in first century Galilee that seem to relate to how Jesus was perceived by his contemporaries. And in this episode, we begin the first of a couple that delve into the issue of Jesus in the role of teacher. It seems quite likely that Jesus was perceived by contemporaries as a rabbi or teacher, and that we can begin to ask the question, what was the method and content? We can begin to ask the question of what was the method and content of the historical Jesus' teachings? In this episode, we begin to introduce those teachings, especially asking the question of what form did his teachings take, and what was the central content of some of that teaching. In particular, we're going to introduce the idea of the reign of God or the kingdom of God. In the next episode, we delve more fully into what Jesus meant specifically, and the debates that go on among scholars regarding what did Jesus mean by the kingdom of God. There are innumerable studies of the historical Jesus that would teach you more about this issue of Jesus in the role of a teacher. You can look at books by people like E.P. Sanders, John P. Meyer, Burton Mack, John Dominic Crossan, and many others who have considered this question and answer in different ways. I hope you enjoy this episode, and do feel free to browse around my website at philipharland.com, where you can learn more about the historical Jesus. So today we look at Jesus as a teacher, and we're going to look at both the methods and forms of his teaching and the content of his teaching. First, let me say a few words about Jesus' audiences, because obviously if you're a teacher, you have to have someone listening to you. So it's worth asking what we can know to some degree of probability about his audiences. First of all, most of the teachings that are early in our sources and multiply attested, and therefore something we can begin to work with as possibilities of what Jesus actually said, points to his audience being peasants. There's talk of 12 disciples in all of our sources, and the occupations that are attributed to those 12 disciples of Jesus as they're in our sources likewise reflect a sort of peasant context. Namely, that not only does Jesus speak to the peasants generally, but he also has a smaller group that follows him. We don't know for sure how often the historical Jesus went to Jerusalem. The answer to that would be related to the question of how much did he make the pilgrimage to the festivals. Gospel of John portrays it as though Jesus is always going to Jerusalem. The Synoptic Gospels portray it as though he hardly ever goes, and it's the main trip at the end, just before his death, when he goes. So he would have audiences in Jerusalem as well, and there you would more likely encounter some of the more educated groups we were talking about previously. There is debate about whether or not Pharisees are very active in Galilee. It's plausible that they were there, but we have no way, beyond the evidence of the Gospels, we have no way of confirming or disconfirming the presence of Pharisees in Galilee. We do know that Pharisees, scribes, and priests are far more active in Jerusalem. So if not in Galilee, at least in Jerusalem, he would encounter that broader audience for his teaching and for engaging in debate with some other Judeans who have different views about how to interpret the Torah and how to live out Judean customs in an everyday way. Let's look at one collection of the teachings of Jesus as an illustration of some of what we could expect Jesus to teach. Now, what is known as the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew is called the Sermon on the Plain in Luke. In our theory of source criticism, it's because Matthew and Luke are using Q. So it seems that in our theory, Q had an inaugural speech of Jesus in its collection of sayings. As usual, as a historian, we don't have the tools to find out exactly which sayings Jesus said or didn't say. Very difficult to pinpoint that. But what we can notice is that much of the material, or quite a bit of the material, but not all of it, in this inaugural speech from Q, is attested elsewhere. For example, it's attested in Gospel of Thomas. Some scholars think the Gospel of Thomas is independent of the Synoptic Gospels, in which case we have multiple attestation of some of these sayings, and they become more solidly grounded for saying they're more likely to have been something Jesus said. Some people, though, argue the Gospel of Thomas is dependent on the Synoptics, so that would just make that multiple attestation disappear completely, if that were the case. I tend to the view that the Gospel of Thomas is largely independent of the Synoptic Gospels or traditions in the Synoptic Gospels. Here's what the inaugural speech had in Q. Generally speaking, when scholars look at Luke and Matthew and how they use Q, they notice that Luke tends to follow Q more closely. Matthew tends to follow Mark more closely. And so you're better off reading Luke if you want to get a better picture of what Q may have looked like. Let me read a little bit of this inaugural speech from chapter 6, verses 12 to 49 of Luke's gospel. These are some of the sayings that are attributed to Jesus here. Then he looked up at his disciples and said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you will be filled. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you and when they exclude you, revile you and defame you on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice on that day and leap for joy, for surely your reward is great in heaven, for that is what their ancestors did to the prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you will be hungry. Woe to you who are laughing now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when all speak well of you, for that is what their ancestors did to the false prophets. But I say to you, listen, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. If anyone strikes you on the one cheek, offer the other also. And from anyone who takes away your coat, give him another." That type of material. A little bit further down in the speech, you have this. He also told them a parable. We'll soon explain what a parable is. This one's sort of a little one-line parable. "Can a blind person guide a blind person? Will not both fall into a pit? A disciple is not above the teacher, but everyone who is fully qualified will be like the teacher. Why do you see the speck in your neighbor's eye, but do not notice the log in your own eye? Or how can you say to your neighbor, 'Friend, let me take out the speck out of your eye,' when you yourself do not see the log in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your neighbor's eye." So this is giving a sense of the type of things that are attributed to Jesus. And as I said, there's a good number of these sayings that are likely to go back to Jesus himself using historical methods. Obviously, they all could. We have no way of knowing, is the point with historical methods. But when we have them multiply attested early on in sources, they're better candidates for things that likely go back to Jesus. But this gives you an overall view of some of the ways he would have taught. From what I've said so far, you can see there are problems in sorting out what exactly Jesus did or did not say, and what is a creation or an interpretation of the authors of the Gospels. It's very difficult to sort all that out. But we've already learned to some degree some of the methods that are used to try and sort it out as best you can. One thing you can say, though, about an overview of the sayings that are attributed to Jesus in the Synoptic Gospels is that there are two main styles or forms of teaching material that are often attributed to Jesus. One is aphorisms, one-liners. I read a couple of those to you already. Here's a one-liner. "Can a blind person guide a blind person? Will not both fall into a pit?" One-liners are wisdom sayings, a wise idea captured within one or two sentences that are meant to make the audience of the teacher think about the issue and see something in a new way just through that one line. The other main form of teaching, other method of teaching that Jesus uses is parables. Parables literally comes from the word, Greek word for throwing alongside of, parabole. Something from everyday life thrown alongside of your main point. It's a story that you tell, drawn from everyday occurrences. And in Jesus' case, everyday occurrences reflect Galilee and Judea and peasant life. So things in his case, drawn from peasant life, from what an everyday person in Galilee would experience, telling a story about what an everyday person would experience in a way that tries to communicate an unknown, a new point you have to make. Sometimes the teacher would then give an application and actually explain things. Sometimes a teacher would not do that. In the Gospels, it becomes clear when you compare one parable of Jesus to another in another source, Matthew to Luke, Gospel of Thomas to Matthew, you begin to see that sometimes it's the later authors who put their meaning and their interpretation afterwards. In other words, we have this, the parable, the story that Jesus told, and perhaps Jesus said what it meant, but maybe not. Later authors giving their opinion on what Jesus' parable means. And if you compare the different versions of the parable, you see different lessons, depending on which source you look at. We know that other Pharisees, other rabbis, other teachers contemporary with Jesus likewise used the parable as a method of teaching. So Jesus is not alone in doing this. He's once again among his contemporaries. He's quite typical. Let me give you an example of a parable attributed to rabbis in the first century. Now, all of our sources about first century rabbis, beyond the Gospels stories about Jesus, who may be conceived as a rabbi, as a teacher, beyond that, all of our sources are later for first century Judean rabbis, teachers, beyond Josephus and the Gospels. Most of them come from Jewish literature known as rabbinic literature. The Mishnah, written in about 200 CE, and the Talmuds, which develop further what's in the Mishnah, and collect together traditions about what earlier teachers taught within Judean culture, what earlier Pharisees taught, and sometimes what earlier Sadducees taught, or what other teachers taught, but mostly what other earlier Pharisees taught. They may preserve material from earlier, but we have almost no way to sort out exactly which things go back earlier. So here are some of the parables attributed to first or early second century characters that I just wanted to give you a sense of how other teachers are using the same style of teaching. Here there's a quotation from Ecclesiastes. Then Solomon in his wisdom said, "Let your garments be always white, and let not your head lack oil." So a quotation from the Hebrew Bible. Then it goes on to have Johanan ben Zakkai give a parable that is trying to express a point he has to make about that quotation. Rabbi Johanan ben Zakkai said, "This is like a king who summoned his servants to a banquet, but he did not set a time for them. The attentive got themselves dressed for the banquet and sat at the door of the king's house. They said," the attentive did, "is anything missing at the king's house? The foolish went on with their work. They said, is there any banquet without toil? Suddenly the king summoned his servants. The attentive gathered before him all dressed up, while the foolish gathered before him all soiled. The king was pleased with the attentive, but angry with the foolish." The main referents of Jesus' parables and the imagery he uses are things from Galilean life. Agriculture, things like planting seeds, harvesting crops, planting vineyards, tending vineyards. Tenants, people that hire out land in order to grow crops and pay someone to borrow the land. Issues of getting loans. We already know quite a bit from reading Horsley's Bandit Prophets and Messiahs that the economic situation of farmers and peasants isn't very good. Sometimes they have to get loans just to be able to keep going in order to buy the seed that they need for the next crop. And so there's stories that Jesus draws from getting a loan or owing people money. He draws on everyday life of kings, like the banquet issue that we're going to look at shortly. If you want to see a collection of parables together in one spot in a gospel, a good place to go is Luke chapters 15 to 16. Most of those are not multiply attested, but some of them are. There you have things like the parable of the 100 sheep, where one sheep is lost, and does a shepherd go looking for the last sheep? This parable of the lost coin. If a woman loses a coin in the house, does she keep looking for it? The parable of the two sons, a rebel son and a kiss-up son. And the kiss-up son sticks around and the rebel son goes away and eventually gets accepted back and gets treated like a king when he returns. A prodigal son, it's known as too. So you have those sorts of parables, and you can look at the examples you have there to get a better idea of what sort of thing Jesus may have taught. Again, it's hard to pinpoint which ones are exactly what Jesus taught. That's not the point we're making. The point we're making is we can say with a high degree of likelihood that Jesus taught in parables and one-liners. Some of the ones we have may be more likely than others to actually go back to Jesus. It's not a late first century author imposing on Jesus a style of teaching that doesn't fit in Galilee. Now, as to the content of these parables, let's talk about that. The one-liners are rarely about the kingdom of God, but almost all of the parables, there are some parables that aren't, but almost all the parables that are attributed to Jesus in the synoptic gospels, John's out in left field again, are about the kingdom of God, this phrase, the kingdom of God. Matthew's favorite redaction of that, his favorite way of editing it whenever he sees it in his source, is the kingdom of the heavens. The question arises, what is the kingdom of God? Does this go back to the historical Jesus? How can we make sense of what he meant by it? That is where the debates come in. The majority of scholars agree that Jesus taught about the kingdom of God. They disagree about what Jesus meant by the kingdom of God. And you've already had that to some degree in our earlier discussion of Sanders and Crossan. Whether or not Jesus taught the kingdom of God and thought of it as an apocalyptic kingdom, or whether he didn't think of it as an apocalyptic kingdom. So that was the debate between Sanders and Crossan that we've already encountered, and we're going to have to delve into it a bit again. And it has to do with whether or not the kingdom is a future thing or a present thing, closely related to apocalyptic or not apocalyptic. We have various criteria that you guys are familiar with. One is criteria of multiple attestation. We'll definitely have that with the kingdom of God material. It's attested in Mark. It's attested in Matthew and Luke when they're taking from Q in our theory. It's attested in the Gospel of Thomas if you believe it is independent. So we have it multiply attested and in material that is considered to be early by most scholars. And one last aspect of the criteria that you're familiar with, one that we haven't encountered a whole lot but that we've talked about nonetheless, dissimilarity. The criterion of dissimilarity that helps us establish the authenticity of this or that saying, or at least the likelihood of this or that saying going back to Jesus, has to do with when there's a saying or teaching of Jesus that is dissimilar from what the church liked to teach, then you're more likely on solid ground testing whether or not it seems to be more authentically going back to Jesus. What I'm pointing out here is the early Christians seem not to have been interested in the kingdom of God, even though all these gospel writers preserve all these sayings of Jesus that talk about the kingdom of God. Look at Paul's letters as an instance of this. Paul's letters are the earliest evidence we have for any Christianity at all, for anyone following Jesus as the Jewish Messiah. Paul's letters come from the 40s, late 40s, or more likely the 50s CE. They predate the Gospels. They don't predate some of the material in the Gospels, but they predate the Gospels in the form we have them. Does Paul use kingdom of God a lot? Hardly at all. But he does not consistently consider kingdom of God a concept to explain or to elaborate on. It just isn't his main way of talking. So the traditions attributed to Jesus are dissimilar from Paul, our earliest evidence for Christianity. Not only that, but the phrase kingdom of God is not common in Judean literature in this time. Now, let me qualify that very carefully. Right now, what I'm talking about is the exact terminology of kingdom of God. Terminology is not widely attested among Judean teachers and writers and authors in this time period. So it's dissimilar from that. However, the concept that Jesus had behind it seems to be very well attested. But what is clear so far is that there's a high likelihood that Jesus was a teacher and that his methods included using parables and aphorisms, short one-liners, and that the content of the parables, at least, were focused on this idea of the kingdom of God. Now let's figure out what this means. When you look at literature contemporary with Jesus, as I said, you don't have the exact phrase, kingdom of God, but you do have widespread in the literature, Judean literature of the time, the idea of God ruling over his creation. God's reign over his creation is a concept in the minds of just about every Judean author. It seems that this is the idea behind Jesus' peculiar phrase, kingdom of God. And when you look through various uses of it in the Gospels, you'll begin to see it's not so much a kingdom in the sense that you might be thinking. Namely, it's not so much a place. What seems to be more likely is that reign is in the mind of Jesus, so to speak, when he talks about the kingdom of God. God's ruling power is what is behind this phrase, kingdom of God. Not so much a place and a territory as it is a power and a reigning activity of God. So this is important to keep in your mind every time you come across kingdom of God. It might be worthwhile just translating it in your mind as reign of God or jurisdiction over which God has power. Now, there's peculiarities to how Jesus interprets what God's reign means, and we'll soon get to that. But he shares in common this idea of God's reign and talking about God's reign over his creation.
That concludes this episode. I hope you'll come again. In the meantime, you can browse my website at philipharland.com.
I like early Christianity.
The opening music of this series in the podcast is Paradise Lost by Namgyal Lamo, a Tibetan artist. You can find her on the web, and you can buy her CDs at Amazon.